king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. And I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be of benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way. The king is dead, long live the king, and there would be another king appointed.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll be asking if, with articles in popular magazines, America is finally waking up this week to the role of the Saudis in 9/11. Same Saudi government, of course, that Britain is making a fortune out of selling arms and munitions to that they're using against the people of Yemen, which even before last year's bombardment started was the poorest country in the Middle East. And then there's Brazil. And in the run-up to this year's Olympic Games, we're seeing the Brazilian establishment and largely private media rounding on President Dilma Rousseff, sending the country back to the bad old days of US colonialism and interference in Latin American politics, as there's an attempt to impeach her. And the latest instalment in our revisiting of the World War II Battle of Arnhem. The film A Bridge Too Far portrays Robert Redford on the bridge at Nijmegen, demanding to know why the British tanks have stopped when a quick charge down the road could win the battle. This week we hear how Dutch resistance fighter Christian Lindemans, he was a suspected German agent, but he was sent in anyway to betray the battle plan 2 days before the Allied paratroops dropped in the biggest airborne operation in history. But I think maybe, Martin, we can start this week by talking a bit about Hillsborough, because it's taken such a long time for the truth to come out about this particular horrendous cover-up. And one does wonder if Britain is really one of the things Britain excels in, is these kinds of obfuscation and keeping the truth out of the public domain and even out of the courts.
Well, I mean, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland has been calling for an inquiry into collusion between the British Crown Forces and various paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland for a long time, but they don't want it to be a British inquiry, because British inquiries have been completely bowdlerised. They were always whitewashes, but now they're complete whitewashes because they're no longer judicial inquiries. They're controlled by government agents, and for any inquiry that they're calling for needs to be an international inquiry. And I think the fact that it does take, I mean, look at the Iraq War inquiry. That's still winding its way through the bowels of Whitehall as
well.
Well,
it's not its ground to a halt, is it?
Well, indeed.
This is the Chilcot report.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, the point is that the whole idea of inquiries traditionally was to kick things into the long grass and hope that it would go away. Things like the Scarman report after the riots in 1981 did come forward quite quickly and did lead to changes in policing. But I think what subsequently happened is that the inquiry system in Britain has become a means of obfuscation and B just a means to kick things down the track and try and avoid any you know, basically kick things into the long grass and make them go
away.
The
horrific thing about Hillsborough really is that it's actually been down to the immediate relatives of those, although there are some others who've supported from outside themselves to make sure that this happened. We had an original inquest or set of inquests into the 96 deaths that was really just a complete whitewash.
Indeed, and I think one of the most...
This is adding insult to injury.
Well, one of the most disgusting things about the whole thing is it's fairly clear that the South Yorkshire Police briefed the Murdoch press that what had happened is that drunken Liverpool fans had not done as they were supposed to do, and it was largely their own fault. That's inexcusable. Accidents happen, mistakes happen. The Heysel Stadium disaster, where it was in fact Liverpool hooligans who brought the house down there. But what happened at Sheffield was the police basically messed it up and then tried to cover their tracks by basically blaming the victims. And of course, the Murdoch press in particular leapt onto that. And, you know, there were completely fictitious stories of Liverpool fans supposedly peeing on their dying colleagues and so forth. All of which, if you think back to the 80s, fed into the sort of, you know, scally scouser culture, these people don't deserve jobs, they aren't work shy, blah, blah, blah. And of course, the other big open sore in South Yorkshire is what happened at Orgreave, where the police attacked the miners and basically carried out a brutal assault on people who were on strike and then tried to blame the people they'd assaulted.
Well, we've had many times on this programme bemoaned the failure of investigative journalism really since around about the year 2000, the late 1990s. But someone I spoke to a couple of years ago is Roger Cook, who had a very good investigative journalistic sting programme called The Cook Report, which started on Central Television, but then was actually, funnily enough, Rupert Murdoch comes in again here because the News of the World smeared him over several weeks on the front page and inside the News of the World around about the year 2000, and he had to take his programme off the air, and it was never brought back on the air. But of course, he was one of the early journalists to get stuck into the Hillsborough story, and here's what he told me.
All this material, which has now come out in the independent panel, we had more or less in chapter and verse 5 years after the event, yet it took another nearly two decades for it to come out, and that is absolutely disgraceful. There was a monster cover-up. People like Deborah Martin, these young policemen we traced, were all heavied. And poor old Deborah Martin was visited by very, very pushy police officers on three occasions who bullied and browbeat her, she says, into changing the original statement we'd made, and lots of people did that. So there was a large-scale, heavy-duty cover-up. I mean, people wanted to believe that the police were decent and the authorities were decent. Well, they were all conspiring, I believe, to make sure that this got swept under the carpet. And I'm very pleased that the independent panel has come to the same conclusion on the same evidence that we presented 18 years ago. You've got to have decent people in charge. And it is said that at Hillsborough there was a major incident plan, but people were cowering under tables and not implementing it. And it's the quality of the staff. If the training and the staff quality isn't there, then there will be another incident of this kind.
The other problem with South Yorkshire Police, Martin, we were just talking about a couple of weeks ago, is the child sexual abuse, and the fact that the police and other authorities in South Yorkshire knew about it but did absolutely nothing about it for something like 13 years.
Well, I mean, the police always have to be held to account, and of course often they haven't been, and this makes this absolutely clear. You know, all these different incidents are different incidents, and everything should be treated on its merits. But what's clear is that the police, instead of putting their hands up and saying, yes, we messed this up, it's a terrible tragedy, we're sorry, immediately went into, how can we cover our backs mode, and then kept that going for 25 years. That is disgusting. And heads should roll for that. Prosecutions, possibly.
Let's just go across the Severn and review what's been going on in Port Talbot. We've been talking again over the last few months about this on and off. What's your assessment of whether this steel plant is going to close and the rights and wrongs of it?
Well, once you've got to this stage of the game, it's very difficult to see what to do. We shouldn't lose our steel industry because it should have been in public ownership, as it was until the mid-1980s, and the reason why you put things like steel industries in public ownership, as it is in China, is because it's a cyclical industry. You need steel. It's an essential building block of a manufacturing economy. But when the economy turns down, steel becomes unprofitable. And that's why it should be in the public sector, so that the profits that are made during the upturn can be used to subsidise the losses that you will make in the downturn, so that you can continue to have a steel industry, which means that you can build things like wind farms and what have you. And steel is required for virtually everything. Construction, it's a fundamental thing that you need to have.
Is it going too far to say this is actually a key part of national defence? I mean,
well, that's another reason why the steel industry in China is in the hands of the public sector, because it's absolutely essential for building things like aircraft carriers and so forth. And everybody understood that. And if you were talking about the EU earlier in the show, I mean, the iron and steel was an iron and steel agreement. It was an iron and steel coal agreement originally, so that everybody would be able to manage having a steel industry, both France and Germany, rather than trying knocking each other's steel industries out. And that's probably what you should be trying to negotiate with the Chinese. We all want a steel industry. We want one. You want one. We don't want to destroy yours. Don't destroy ours. But I think the problem is that we've not had an industrial policy in this country since 1979, effectively. And therefore, we've just presumed that the market, whatever that is, will determine the outcomes. So the subsidised Chinese steel industry, it's perfectly logical for the Chinese government to subsidise their steel industry, ends up surviving at the expense of ours.
Well, look, the biggest players in the steel industry in Europe are ThyssenKrupp, the German firm, mm-hmm. which is a merger of Thyssen and Krupp, funnily enough. Thyssen's were the company that did deals with the Nazi Party in the late 1920s and early 30s, where they said, okay, let's have a nice deal with these politicians, whereby what happens is every ton of steel we sell, we'll give a nice donation to the Nazi Party. That was Thyssen's. And Krupp's were the people that built the Tiger tanks for the Second World War. Mm. Now, ThyssenKrupp have been talking to behind the scenes about the possibility of taking over Tata and doing deals with Tata. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about that, but we've heard no actual discussion about that in the press at all. And I wonder if that may be related to this EU referendum where ThyssenKrupp are thinking, well, obviously, if Britain goes for Brexit, then we're not going to be interested in that plant.
Well, that may be so, Tony. I think it's most unlikely that they'll want to pick it up, because I'm afraid what's going to happen is we're now in a deflationary wave, that nobody's steel industry is going to be profitable, and it's who can subsidise their steel industry to survive. And we can't afford it. The Chinese can, because they have had an industrial policy and we haven't. If the Germans were prepared to take over Port Talbot, I'm quite sure people in South Wales would be overjoyed. But I'm afraid the situation is relatively dire. I would argue that in any case it should be nationalised, because even if you're going to run it down, you should run it down in an orderly fashion, not just switch it off, so that the people concerned can make the necessary changes without just being thrown in at the deep end. That's another reason why it should be in public ownership. But if it's taken into public ownership, you can't guarantee that it will survive, unless we can change national government policy towards an investment in infrastructure which would require more steel. That means a change of government in Westminster. I can't see that on the horizon in the timescale required to keep those furnaces going.
There's a chap called Jonathan Aylan at Manchester Business School, I heard on talking on Five Live a few weeks ago, and he points out that Tata basically has got two identical plants, of which Port Talbot is only one.
Port Talbot makes strip steel, which goes into car bodies and cans and consumer durables. And that's very much a different product and a very different set of circumstances too, because Tata Steel have a large European works at IJmuiden in the Netherlands making exactly the same products. So naturally, Tata Steel are very reluctant to see anyone take over Port Talbot and making a success and become a competitor to their favoured works at IJmuiden. In fact, we can anticipate that the order book is already migrating from South Wales to Holland as we speak.
Interesting that, you know, that essentially, I mean, any business manager would look at these two plants and say, well, look, with demand as it is, we can't keep both open. How come the Dutch are so much better at making sure that their plants stay open than we are, Martin?
Well, one of the things is that they're not whinging on about leaving the EU, Tony, quite possibly. But in any case, there is a glut in the steel market anyway, because the economy is about to crash. The banks are still insolvent. Everything is going to go down the drain. And at that point, everybody's steel industry will crash. What should have been happening, what the original conception of the European Union was, as I just explained earlier, is that we all know that everybody's steel industry is vulnerable to downturns. So what you do is you negotiate that everybody gets a piece of the action of the steel industry. That's what we should be doing with the Chinese, that's what we should be doing with the Germans, the Dutch and everybody else. And we would demand our fair share of the action as part of an overall plan for the world economy. But we haven't got an overall plan for the world economy. Everything's run by Wall Street and they're only interested in money now, not in 10 years' time, not in 15 years' time, not in 5 minutes from now.
I asked Helen Holland just before the 6 o'clock news about this, but there's this controversy raging over the last couple of days with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, or alleged anti-Semitism. Ken Livingstone has been suspended. He hasn't been kicked out of the Labour Party. And this is coming at a very interesting time, isn't it? Because we've got an election in the offing, and it looks almost certain that Ken Livingstone's disciplinary hearing will take place after that election. So it's a sort of a running sore in the run-up to the local elections.
Well, it's basically a political move by the right wing of the Labour Party in cahoots with very powerful Zionist forces which operate in this country, some of them inside the Labour Party, some outside the Labour Party. For example, the Murdoch Press, which is virtually 100% pro-Israeli in everything that it says
and
does.
So the BBC is as well, is it?
Well, the BBC pretty much so, because they take their cue from Murdoch.
I don't know about that. I mean, certainly they seem to be sort of fighting with Murdoch quite a lot of the time too. But Martin, anyway, let's have a listen now to what Ken Livingstone actually said on the radio yesterday morning, and just see if we can work out if it really is anti-Semitic or not, and maybe preempt that hearing.
Let's remember, when Hitler won his election in 1932, his policy then was that Jews should be moved to Israel. He was supporting Zionism, and his boy went mad and ended up killing 6 million Jews. But the simple fact in all of this is that Naz made these comments at a time when there's another brutal Israeli attack on the Palestinians.
Well, there he is. He's saying that Hitler is supporting Zionism, Martin. Is he right?
There was a deal done between the Zionists in Germany and the Nazis to move the idea of the Zionists, don't forget, were a minority in the Jewish community in Germany, as elsewhere in this era, and they were quite keen to do a deal with the Nazi Party to shift the Jewish population to Israel. And they, in actual fact, it led to a scoping mission with a leading Zionist and an SS colonel going to Palestine to look into the details of it. It didn't come to anything. And ultimately, as Livingstone points out, Hitler's absolutely genocidal attitude towards the Jews eventually took over. But of course, in the early days of the Nazi regime, when, you know, Neville Chamberlain and Queen Elizabeth's mother were all quite friendly towards the Germans and the Nazis, when they were talking about solving the Jewish problem, that was regarded very relatively benignly in British establishment circles, for example, the Pinay Circle and so forth. And all they were discussing, of course, it's ethnic cleansing and unacceptable. But of course, the Zionists needed anti-Semitism in order to justify their own policy of transshipping the Jews of the world to Israel. Most Jews in the world do not live in Israel, even today.
But aren't you putting the cart before the horse there? I mean, that policy was there anyway. It's not as if the Zionists needed it. It was there. They were reacting to it, surely.
The Zionist desire to take over Palestine goes back to the 1890s. Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement. But the Zionists were never very powerful within the Jewish community in Germany or elsewhere. In Poland, before the World War II, the Zionist movement was minuscule. The real powerful Jewish force in Poland, and you had millions of Polish Jews, was the Jewish Socialist Bund. And they were left-wing socialists of a similar ilk to Ken Livingstone, and they argued that we're not going going anywhere. We just want a fair crack of the whip where we live in Poland. Marek Edelman, I remember speaking at Speaker's Corner years ago during the 1991 Gulf War, and various Zionist activists were in the audience, and I said, Marek Edelman has called for the complete withdrawal of Israel to its 1948 borders. And they said, who is he? He must be some self-hating Jew. I said, you don't even know who he is, do you? And the audience here listening to our show probably don't know who he is. I'll tell you who he is. He was the commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, a Jewish socialist. And do you know what? At the end of the war, he didn't go to Israel. He stayed and lived on in Warsaw, working as a doctor under the communist regime, and then eventually was a supporter of Solidarność in the 1980s. But he called for Israel to abide by international law unreservedly. And he never emigrated to Israel. He had no interest in living in Israel. He was Polish and Jewish and socialist.
And probably quite a lot of Orthodox Jews would say the same sort of thing, wouldn't they? Because many of them are against the Zionist plan and Israel. But anyway, Martin, the thing that weirded me out yesterday about this was that we were talking about this only last month. It's called the Transfer Agreement, or the Havara Agreement, which was done between the Nazi regime as it was in 1933 and the Zionists. And thankfully, a Jewish chap called Edwin Black has written a book all about it. And here's a US news report that we played at the beginning of last month, too, just for a couple of minutes, what that book is really all about.
Dr. Stephen S. Wise, rabbi of the Free Synagogue and a national leader of liberal thought, speaks in behalf of the Jews of the United States.
This is not a Jewish meeting. This is the conscience of America making itself felt.
The conscience of Nazi Germany made itself felt 5 days later. Across the Reich, Hitler's troops shut down Jewish-owned businesses for 24 hours. Within days, American Jews marched calling for the boycott of all German exports. Jews throughout Europe echoed that call. So did Jews everywhere. But a group of Zionists at the same time was quietly negotiating an agreement with the Nazis to allow the immigration of German Jews and the transfer of their assets to Palestine. That deal, reported in August 1933, was the Transfer Agreement. Palestine, sparsely settled by Jews at the time, was radically changed as a result.
I lived in Palestine from 1933 to 1936, and we saw every week transports of German Jews coming to settle in Palestine. And many new professions were introduced by them into the country, and they played a leading role in making Palestine then a more advanced and progressive country.
German-Jewish settlement of Palestine was, for a time, official Nazi policy. These photos of Jewish life in Palestine, along with a lengthy text, appeared in 1934 in the Berlin paper Der Angriff. The publisher, Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. A Nazi Visits Palestine was the title of the multi-part series. A medal was struck by Goebbels in commemoration. On one side, the swastika. On the other, the Star of David. Hitler demanded one concession for the transfer agreement, that the call for a boycott of the Reich raised by Jews here and elsewhere be rejected by the Zionists. The Zionists made that concession.
Interesting. But, I mean, the thing is to try and bring this up to date a little bit and look at it almost on today's situation. It would maybe a bit flippant to say, but, Martin, it's almost like if we had a BNP government here in Britain doing some sort of agreement with ISIS to get Muslims out of Britain.
I don't think anybody imagines that the Zionists who made the deal with Hitler had any delusions about Hitler. But on the other hand, it's simply historical fact that they shared the aims of the Nazi Party. Don't forget that the basic premise of Zionism is that Jews and non-Jews can't get along, which is why the Jews have to have their own place to go, to wit, Palestine. And that actually suited the policy of the Nazis at that stage, which hadn't become so clearly exterminist as it later became. And now you could argue that the Zionists were basically being led up the garden path there. But the point is that there is a congruence between the two. And I think what's underlying all of this is a question about the legitimacy of the state of Israel. All of this hoo-ha in the Labour Party and the trade unions, like the NUS, is about anybody who questions the right of the state of Israel to exist must be an anti-Semite. Now, I beg to differ. There are different views upon the right of the state of Israel to exist or not exist. But in 1948, the state of Israel was recognised, first of all, by the Soviet Union and then by others, but not by the British initially.
I think it was first by the US.
It was actually by the Soviet Union, I think you'll find. But we can check this. Anybody can check this. It doesn't matter. It was recognised. But the principle on which it was recognised was to stick within the borders that had been agreed, and that all Palestinians who had been expelled should be able to return to their homes where they were born, which is exactly the kind of deal that we tried to force through in Bosnia when I was an aid worker there. People have got to be allowed to go back to where they came from. Ethnic cleansing cannot be rewarded. Now, in actual fact, throughout the period of Israel's existence, they have refused to allow Palestinians who were kicked out of Israel to come back. Now, that means that the whole question of the state of Israel's recognition by the United Nations is open, especially at the minute when they are not prepared to negotiate in any way, shape or form with representatives of the Palestinians. Now, at that point, it really does become a moot point whether Israel should be a member of the United Nations. And I think that is why we're seeing all this fuss now, because that is now coming onto the agenda. If you're not prepared to negotiate in good faith, then we're not necessarily prepared to recognise you. And that's been the position of Hamas, for example, from the get-go. We might be prepared to recognise you as long as you recognise us. But if you don't recognise us, we're under no obligation to recognise you. And your seat at the United Nations is provisional. And if you do not fulfil United Nations resolutions, it can and possibly will be withdrawn. And that's why there's a big fuss about it.
Watching the news last night, I must admit I was wondering about the whole business of John Mann having a go at Ken Livingstone as he was arriving at Millbank for his Daily Politics programme. Two things, really. You don't normally get the BBC cameramen hanging around outside waiting for things to happen to film. And also, how did John Mann know that Ken Livingstone was turning up at that particular point? It almost looked like that episode was set up.
Well, if you look at what's going on in the wider Labour movement, various activists in the Labour movement, not just Naz Shah, but in Oxford University Labour Club and elsewhere, have been accused of anti-Semitism. Now, this is an orchestrated attack by Zionist political operatives working with the right wing of the Labour Party, who are very unhappy with the direction that Corbyn is taking them in. Now, if we're going to have a row about this, and I heard Helen Holland earlier saying that she supported Ken Livingstone's suspension, I'm disappointed to hear that, but if we're going to have a row about this, then we'll have to have a row about it. And it could lead to a situation where the party does split. And if that's what they want, then maybe that's where we'll have to go. That's where we went in New Zealand. That's what happened in the New Zealand Labour Party in the 1980s. The left and the right split. And of course they forced PR, and then the left had an overwhelming victory in the follow-on elections. Now, if the right wing of the Labour Party want to line up with Benjamin Netanyahu and his chums, that's up to them. But they will pay the political price.
Now, talking of racism, if this was racism, we'll find out. The five most shocking quotes of Oliver Letwin and his racist memo. The discos and drugs, vandalism and decay. This is where he's talking about the riots in the 1980s. Mr. Letwin dismissed proposals by two government ministers to invest in a scheme designed to encourage black entrepreneurs, suggesting such an initiative would only lead to them spending the money on discos and drugs. Is that racism?
Yes, it is. And of course, in a sense, what you're just saying, I mean, was Cameron accusing Sadiq Khan of being pro-ISIS because he was on shared a platform with a Tory imam? Was that racist? Well, it was, basically. Interestingly enough, a Tory MP, Fletcher, I think his name was, in the debate about Philip Green ripping off BHS stores, accused him of being Judas for selling out the employees of the store. Is that racism? I don't know. Is it anti-Semitism?
Another thing Oliver Letwin was saying, and of course, you know, he's not Ken Livingstone, way away from power. He's actually a cabinet office minister right now. He said lower class and unemployed white people live for years in appalling slums without a breakdown in public order or anything like the present scale. In the midst of the depression, people in Brixton went out, leaving their grocery money in a bag at the front door and expecting to see groceries there when they got back. Effectively, he's saying white people don't riot.
That's just basically wrong. The biggest and most destructive riot in Britain was in the 1832, I think it was, in Bristol, where 250 people died. And that was white working class rioters.
Also, Mr. Letwin said that riots had nothing to do with racism against black communities.
Well, the Scarman report, which we mentioned earlier, concluded otherwise. I used to live in Brixton before the first riot. The local police were racist. They were. And I don't say that with any pleasure. And I think the police force have actually learned an awful lot and changed an awful lot since those years. But they were openly, aggressively racist. And ultimately, they provoked the people who responded to their provocation. And of course, we're also ignoring everything that had been going on in Northern Ireland since 1969, where white people of both Protestant and Catholic extraction have been rioting pretty successfully, killing soldiers and policemen, etc. But of course, that's happening somewhere on Mars, not part of the United Kingdom, at least not UKIP's United
Kingdom. So how do we compare the treatment of Oliver Letwin by the press and by his party to Ken Livingstone?
Well, I think the point is that racism is unacceptable whoever expresses it. But Ken Livingstone has not expressed anything racist. He has taken issue with the political issue around all of this. Is, are we going to put sanctions on Israel for repressing Gaza and the West Bank in the same way as we put sanctions on Russia for supposedly oppressing the people of Crimea who voted to rejoin Russia?
I think he'd probably compare sanctions, it more
sanctions,
to the
That's
South
what
Africans,
this is all about, really.
He would probably compare it more to the South African sanctions.
Well, indeed, he would. And I think that if we're going to have a robust discussion about Zionism and the state of Israel, then let's have it. Let's have it. I'm increasingly of the view that Israel should have a right to exist, provided it abides by international law. But they've been given every opportunity to abide by international law over recent decades. They've absolutely refused to do it. They turn further and further to the right. We know that they are helping ISIS inside Syria, as are our own security forces.
But Martin, one of the reasons for
so
that...
So ultimately,
Martin,
we're going to have to confront
Martin,
that.
One of the reasons for that is that they're under an insurgency from the Palestinians.
Well, they're under an insurgency from the Palestinians. Don't forget that the state of Israel came about because of an insurgency by Irgun and the Haganah against the British. And in fact, the King David Hotel, when 200 British and Palestinian workers were killed by the Haganah, that's a heroic deed in the annals of the Zionist state. Just as the attempt to kill Margaret Thatcher is still a heroic deed in West Belfast. We all live in the real world. And when Hezbollah kill Israeli soldiers, they think it's a heroic deed. Everybody thinks it's heroic deeds when they're fighting a war. The question is, are we going to settle this, or are we going to carry on to the end and sort it out in physical, violent terms? I would argue that the Israelis are now in no position to argue for peace. They have turned their backs on peace, and if the other side determine to go to war with them, they're not doing it because they're obviously completely outgunned, but they've got every justification under international law for saying, right, we're not talking peace to you, you get back behind that green line or we will fight you. That's what we said when Serbia tried to take over Kosovo. We said, you back out of Kosovo or we will bomb you to pieces. And not only did we make the threat, we carried it out. And at the time, Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, did not support NATO's attack on Serbia because he realised that it set a precedent that ultimately, if people are not allowed to make land grabs in the 21st century or the 20th century as it then was, then we will be in the dark. Because you can't just go around taking people's land. The Golan Heights have now been annexed by Israel in complete defiance of international law. That is, what that leads to is A, sanctions, B, war. And that everybody's got to be realised. I'm not a pacifist. I'm like Hillary Benn. Sometimes you have to fight. And if people won't listen to reason, then maybe you've got to kill their soldiers and keep killing their soldiers until they get the message.
BCFM.
Martin, let's go and have a look at, or come back really, to have a look at some stuff a bit closer to home. UK output, industrial output slides, a trade deficit widens on a darker global outlook. Britain's industrial output shrank the fastest rate in more than 3 years in the 3 months to February, and the trade deficit has ballooned to its widest in 8 years, data showed, adding to worries of a broader economic slowdown. Chancellor George Osborne has warned at the start of the year that the economy faced a cocktail of risks due to the spillover from a slowdown in China and a slump in commodity prices. There are also jitters at home in the run-up to the June 23rd referendum on whether to leave the European Union. Some of these dangers now appear to be materialising, with industrial output, which makes up 15% of Britain's economy, shrinking by 1.5% in the 3 months to February, its steepest decline since late 2012. We've also seen a whole spate of bad results from the banks, big drops in profits, including RBS today, Martin.
Well, it's what I've been saying week in, week out on this show. The banks are insolvent. They've always been insolvent. They are still insolvent. They have been printing money and having zero interest rate policies all over the world to try and save the financial system and hopefully to restart the world economy. But because they didn't carry out a genuinely Keynesian policy of investing in infrastructure, which would then lead to your steel industry being viable, nobody's done that. They've just bailed the banks out. That's what we've done. We've bailed the banks out rather than the steel industry. And that's why the steel industry will go down, but the banks will also go down because they're unviable. They've always been unviable. There is going to be a crash. It will happen before the next election in this country, and then people will really wake up to what a mess Margaret Thatcher and her successors have left this country.
It does almost seem like a kind of economic warfare, that somehow the economy is being used really to punish the nation into a state where actually we're not economically viable anymore.
It's not just Britain that's not economically viable.
Well, it's Greece and Spain and Italy.
We've got particular problems to do with what I call the inflationist block in the southeast of England. Everything in Britain is run to keep homeowners happy so that Tories can win elections, so that landowners and stockbrokers can make their money. And of course, that is actually completely pernicious for the peripheral regions of the UK, in which you might include anything north of Birmingham. So this has been going on for years, and the consequence will be when we get the financial crash, Britain is most vulnerable to it. We've virtually do nothing else except finance and services. So when that crashes, we won't be able to go back to fishing like the Icelanders.
The Department for Work and Pensions could be forced to publish secret details of benefit claimant suicides. The government had previously refused to make public details of the 49 cases the department had investigated where benefit claimants had killed themselves. This is in the Independent last week. Secret government investigations into the suicides of other deaths of benefit claimants may have to be partly published after DWP lost its legal appeal. Freedom of Information Tribunal ruled that they were wrong to refuse to hand over any details of the 49 cases department had investigated where benefit claimants had killed themselves or died after cuts to their financial support. The decision by the First Tier Information Rights Tribunal will mean that, pending any appeal by the DWP, the government will be forced to hand over details of the investigations that do not directly relate to those who died. So, I mean, this is it's nearly 50 people here have just come a cropper, basically, from the government's cuts. And one of the interesting things here will be to see if there was any kind of justification to take their benefits away.
Well, that's right. And, of course, they're trying to cover this up. I mean, anecdotally, we all know that this has been a disastrous démarche. And, of course, the reason why they've done it is because opinion polls show that in the marginal constituencies in our rigged electoral system, it's the sort of thing that goes down well amongst homeowners and potential homeowners. And that's how you win elections in Britain. Not by looking after people at the bottom who don't bother to vote anyway. Who cares? Throw them out of the balloon. I'm all right, Jack. Pull up the ladder.
OK, on to another international story. Back to the wider world. Russia signs contracts worth $950 million for Syria reconstruction. Damascus and Moscow have signed nearly $1 billion worth of agreements to rebuild war-torn Syria, according to Prime Minister Vail al-Halki. The two countries intend to develop energy, trade, finance and other sectors of the economy. The Russian side has responded to the idea of restoring Syrian infrastructure. Therefore, a lot of deals were signed, including $675 million and a $280 million agreements, said the Syrian Prime Minister. Now, this is the Russian end of disaster capitalism, Naomi Klein's book.
Well, you could see it that way. I think what will be very interesting about this is what the Russian attitude will be towards the so-called Islamic pipeline from Iran through Syria to Tartus, which is then going to supply natural gas to Europe, because that will be in competition with their own gas supplies to Europe from Russia. And of course, the whole war has been started by the Qataris, the Saudis, the Western intelligence services, because they want to build a pipeline from Qatar through Syria to Turkey and get the Russians out of the European gas market that way. I think, like the gas markets, a bit like steel markets, you need to have agreement to have everybody in the game. And that requires everybody to, you know, OPEC exists in theory to regulate the market. And it's not, free markets don't really exist,
folks. But do you take the point? I mean, so these devastating, horrific wars, that there's actually money to be made. This is the problem. It's actually an incentive in some ways.
Well, there is. And, of course, if the regime change that the Gulf states and the West had wanted in Syria happened, they'd be the ones getting the reconstruction contracts, as they did in Iraq, although there wasn't much reconstruction. I think the problem is with starting these wars is easy enough, and Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, pointed the finger firmly at the British for starting the war in Syria. Then starting wars is easy enough, but finishing them is a real pain. Nobody can actually benefit from a situation where violence continues. Pipelines are incredibly vulnerable to attack, as FARC have shown in Colombia, as the Kurds will now demonstrate in Turkey. And basically, war is a disaster for everybody except those who make money from war. But of course, there are plenty of those people.
Earlier this month, thousands of Egyptian civilians have been tried in military courts, says Human Rights Watch. Now, this is Agence France-Presse report from the 13th of this month. Thousands of Egyptian civilians have been tried in military courts since President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi passed the law expanding military court jurisdictions in October 2014. A New York-based watchdog reported at least 7,420 Egyptians have faced trial in military courts over the last 18 months. Well, this is totally wrong, isn't it? Ordinary civilians being court-martialed.
Well, and it's been mainly directed against the Muslim Brotherhood, who have not responded with violence, even though thousands of their members have been imprisoned, tortured and killed. But, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria has responded with violence to the secular government there, and not only have we supported them, our special forces and intelligence services have armed and trained them and given them weaponry, such as weaponry to shoot down aircraft and take out tanks and so forth. What if the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is more moderate, was to take up arms against the Egyptian government? Oh, well, we're supplying arms to the Egyptian government. But surely the RAF will go in, like in Libya, and knock out the Egyptian tanks as the revolutionaries and rebels and freedom fighters overthrow the military government like they're doing in Syria. So let's have an uprising in Egypt, eh? Which the British will support, as they supported the uprising in Syria and Libya.
Had the Arab Spring, lots and lots of people died in that whole episode, and now it looks as if the military government is back in power with a vengeance. And now, of course, al-Sisi was a very close friend and government minister of, I think he was a defence minister, of Mubarak. So nothing's changed. In fact, it's got far worse.
Indeed.
And all that's happened in Egypt is that the democratic government that was elected under Morsi have been identified. Anyone that was a political activist has been identified, and now they're going through military courts, for goodness sake.
Indeed, and if they were to take up arms against this undemocratic, unrepresentative government, who could say they shouldn't? When Libyan rebels fight, it's good. When Syrian rebels fight, it's heroic. When Egyptians take up arms, oh no, that's terrible. Now, in actual fact, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. When Hamas, which is the elected government of Palestine, declares war on Israel, that's absolutely what happens, isn't it? They should be allowed to do that. Nobody can stop it. We all agree that war and uprising is the way to sort things out. Assad must go. Gaddafi must go. The Israelis must go. Let's have a war. That's our policy. That's British policy. Except it's not British policy. British policy is just a load of hypocritical garbage. And we are actually directly responsible for the war in Syria. As I mentioned earlier, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, pointed the finger directly at Britain for starting the war in Syria. He was approached and said, "Do you want to run an uprising in Syria? Because that's what we are going to do." British officials, the British special forces have been training the rebels in Syria. Are we going to train the rebels in Egypt too?
Brazil's Rousseff. This is going across to the country where the Olympics are taking place later this year. Brazil's Rousseff may appeal to Mercosur if impeached illegally, and this is Reuters saying this. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff denounced her impeachment as a coup to an international audience on Friday, said she would appeal to the Mercosur bloc of South American nations for Brazil to be suspended if the democratic process is broken. "I would appeal to the democracy clause from now on, a rupture of what I consider a democratic process," she told reporters in New York. Mercosur has a democratic clause that can be triggered when an elected government is overthrown in any of its member states, as happened in Paraguay in 2012. Breach results in suspension from meetings and can lead to the country's losing its trade benefits. But Rousseff, is she right? Is this a coup? Is she being impeached? And what's the background to all this, Martin?
Well, there is no hard evidence that she has been involved in corruption personally. Even the people that want her out don't accuse her of personally being corrupt. What the charge against her is that she fiddled the books to suggest that the national debt was not as bad as it seemed.
That sounds now, exactly, I think, like what Goldman Sachs were doing in Italy and in Greece.
Yeah. Well, it's also the sort of thing that George Osborne does every day before breakfast. Should he be impeached? Perhaps he should. What do you think, Tony?
What about the run-up to the Olympics, though? Because it's highly charged, isn't it? There'll be people from all over the world going there. And who are the people that are taking over from the democratically elected president?
Well, it'll be the vice president, who is from the Brazilian Social Democrat Party, which is actually a sort of Blairite neocon party. So they will get what they want. They're basically on the offensive in Latin America. They overthrew the government of... I'm talking about the US here. They overthrew the government of Paraguay. They overthrew the government of Honduras. And in actual fact, there's been a murder. There's been lots of murders of journalists and green activists in Honduras since the coup. Hardly reported in our press, but very strongly supported by Hillary Clinton, the coup.
I would actually point out as well that about 3 or 4 months before the presidential elections in Brazil, one of the front runners, who was a socialist, died in a mysterious plane crash.
Indeed, indeed. Brazil was a military government from 1964 until the late 1970s, strongly supported by US and Britain. Now, what do we say? Assad must go. Gaddafi must go. It's time to fight. What should we do with the Brazilian military if they back a coup against
the
government?
Aren't I right that in the Brazilian military government, there are also quite a lot of ex-SS people over there helping them?
There's an awful lot of people from the ex-Nazi party and intelligence structure who were infiltrated into Latin America by Operation Paperclip, by the Western intelligence.
I think
services.
Klaus Barbie was one, as I
indeed,
remember.
Indeed, who was given by the CIA the job of training the Bolivian army, that eventually captured and executed Che Guevara.
Now let's go back again, come back home again, because we ought not to go without talking about the MP's porn star lover, who was shown cabinet papers, John Whittingdale, in a new sex scandal as a second lover reveals she had an affair with him. This seems to roll on and on, but there seems to be no... inkling of the idea that because the culture secretary is in charge of the review at the moment of the BBC is involved with these prostitutes, who apparently he didn't know were prostitutes and was showing them cabinet papers, doesn't seem to matter at all.
Well, the implication has always been that the Murdoch empire does its business, and you know, Paul Dacre and the Daily Mail, they collect dirt on people. Look, think about the MP's expenses scandal, where certain people's expenses just weren't... They had everybody's expenses, but we never found out about Tony Blair's expenses, because he was a good little boy who did everything that they wanted. Whittingdale was in a position where they could have brought all this out, but they didn't. And that's why he ended up being in charge of culture, media and sport, because he'd be absolutely reliable in terms of doing what they wanted, because they got all this dirt on him. But the dirt's come out anyway, and now the question has to be raised, well, you know, what's going on here?
Yeah, certainly. Also, let's just go back to Hillsborough before we go on to the Arnhem story. One of the tweets I tweeted earlier on this week was about the Hillsborough cover-up police Freemasons being in the same lodge. The two top Hillsborough cover-up police in the same lodge, apparently. But the coroner steered the jury away from looking at any of these Masonic connections. I wonder if you think there's anything wider to gain from that, in that the coroner surely should be interested in connections between people who are involved in a cover-up, whatever organisation they're in, or you know, maybe it's a golf club or anything. Why is the coroner saying, well, no, the jury, you should not draw any conclusions from the fact that these people are both in the same secret society in the same lodge?
Well, I'm not a judge, as you might have noticed, Tony. I think what he may be doing is saying, don't prejudice yourself by thinking in those terms. Just look at the facts in front of you. But, of course, if a further investigation, and there should be a further police investigation now of the cover-up, then it certainly does become relevant, and something that the investigating officers should certainly look into.
When we were chatting to the police and crime commissioners here last week, which is a show you can go back and have a listen to on YouTube if you want to, with all the questions. You can go straight to whichever question interests you. I brought up the Freemasons. Kerry Barker, who's standing as the Labour candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner, explained that it definitely was a problem in places like Chester and Portsmouth that he worked in the past, where many of the magistrates were basically just recruiting other Freemasons to be magistrates. Now, when the criminal justice system starts to get lots of Freemasons in it, in various lodges, in whether they're actually a magistrate, another could be a police officer, another could be a barrister, another could be a judge.
Well, it's been going on for years, Tony, as
but
we all know.
Stevens?
The argument is that it was going on, but it is no longer.
But what Sue Mount Stevens says
is... I have my doubts about
what Sue Mount Stevens said, the present Police and Crime Commissioner, is that their declaration of their Masonic membership now is only voluntary.
Well, that's not really very much of a deterrent then, is it? I think the point is that people who want to fix things behind the scenes find ways to do it, and Freemasons' lodges is one of the places they go to do it. And, of course, the most notorious example of that is the P2 lodge in Italy, which was full of stuff full of intelligence agents, industrialists and police officers.
And the other thing
which were involved in all the terrorism in the 70s and 80s.
Is the Operation Tiberius that took place in the Metropolitan Police, which uncovered all sorts of links between Freemasons in and out of the police, and said that actually it was the most difficult end of police corruption to get to the bottom of, which is well worth taking another look at, I would say, to the coroner, rather than saying don't look here. Anyway, we're going to go now to our latest instalment in the revisiting the World War II Battle of Arnhem. The film A Bridge Too Far portrayed Robert Redford on the bridge at Nijmegen, demanding to know why the British tanks had stopped when a quick charge down the road could have won the battle. And I spoke to a former SAS man, and he was also one of the people who was in charge of starting ABC television back in the 1950s, whose father was working for Montgomery during the Second World War. And this is what he had to say about what he discovered about the Battle of Arnhem when he spoke, had lunch in Jermyn Street in London at a cafe with a chap who'd been an intelligence officer in Holland, a Dutch guy working for the British Army, actually just in the run-up to the Operation Market Garden battle.
I had lunch with a man called Colonel Pinto. There was a very popular BBC programme called Spy Catcher, and he was a Dutchman, and he worked for the British. He told me this story, that he and his team were the people that went behind the British Army in Holland, and what they did was to get hold of all the people when they, the officials and everything else, put them into camps to then sort them out and find out whether there are any Nazis or people of risky character. He had a number two who had a photographic memory. He could say to him, so-and-so, so-and-so, what we know about him, and he'd be able to almost recite it off straight away. Very good number two. Anyway, the story is this man told me. They were going through the people that they were capturing at that time, and he that night went out for dinner. When he came back, it was sort of, I don't know, late in the night, 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock like that, and he went up towards the gates for his camp, where all these people were imprisoned temporarily, to check them all out before they were released. And the English sentry, who had just an ordinary rifle, was standing outside there, being harassed and having a hell of an argument with a great tall man, big man, with two girls on his arms. And when the sentry saw Colonel Pinto coming, he said, "Sir, sir." So Pinto walked across, a very experienced man, you see, and looked at this big chap standing there, you see. "What's going on here?" He said, "Sir," he said, "this man's trying to take two of these girls from inside the camp out. I'm not allowed to let them go." And he said, and this chap stood with Schmeisser on one thing, Luger automatics on another, grenades and God knows what, you see. So Pinto looked at him and said, "What's your name?" And he said, "King Kong." King Kong. He was boasting, of course, you see. But what his real name was, Lindemann Christians. This man was a bully and very big. Pinto was not, you see. And he noticed that he had a captain's pips on his arm, on his sleeve. And when this man was threatening the colonel...
What, you mean for a British Army captain?
Yes, yes, you see. But yes, so the Dutchman, King Kong, had got his pips here on the sleeve, which, of course, you can't have. And so when he was trying to browbeat the colonel, he went forward and grabbed the things and pulled them off him and said, "How dare you have your pips on your sleeve?" And when he did that, the man shrunk because he was found out. And he went off, and the two girls were put back in again. Next morning, Pinto went into his office. This is first hand, I can tell you. Went into his office and said to this number two, "What do we know about King Kong?" "Oh," he said, "it's the famous Rezzo." Rezzo, that is a defence partisan gang, as it were, a Rezzo in France. "And who was in this Rezzo?" It was run by a man called Lindemans Christians. He said, well, we'll do immediate checks on this man. And they started doing checks for several hours on his background. What they found out, that this Rezo was betrayed, and every man in it was killed, with one exception, Lindemans Christians. So he said, let's look at it. We must immediately go and get an arrest warrant, and we'll go to his camp and arrest this man. We've got to look into him. So they got the warrant, went across to the Dutch headquarters there, you see, and went in, spoke to the duty officer, whatever it is, we've got a warrant here for a man called Lindemans Christians. We want to interrogate him. Oh, I said, so you can't interrogate him. He's the head of the King Kong Rezo. He's one of the top patriots in our country. They said, nevertheless, we wish to interrogate him. And they said, no, you will have to have a much more higher arrest warrant than this. And it will have to be with a counter stamp of the Netherlands. You've got a British one. You're in Holland now and you will need this. So he said, right, we'll get it. So they left. And it took them a day to get it. Following morning, he went back, Colonel Pinto, with his number two, with a properly filled in warrant for the arrest. And when they went in, they said, well, it's terribly sorry, it's late. He's gone on a mission. Mission was to tell the Germans of the British invasion of Alamein, Operation Market Garden. He betrayed them. Now, years later, I think it was maybe 10 or 15 years later, there was such a kerfuffle in Holland that they were told that Lindemans Christians, in fact, did not commit suicide and die in the hospital where he was, that they exhumed his body. And he was, in fact, the correct body in the correct grave, Lindemans Christian. But he was the one that let the Germans know, and they had their reserve units there, as you know. They knew 24 hours beforehand what was going to happen. Talking about Montgomery, his main intention was to get further in, to meet the Russians as soon as he could, as far away from where they were as they possibly could. But Montgomery, in this case, now, if I had been Montgomery, not anybody, but if I had been Montgomery, if I got every man, when the tanks couldn't get along the roads because it was mud, I'd have given them all rifles, you know what I mean, and I would have sent them. A man who I went to Libya with, he was a private in 6th Airborne Division. He said, we entrained 5 times to go to the rescue of Arnhem. We had all the aircraft ready. And we entrained, but each time it was cancelled. So we were ready to go and help. In my opinion, we should have gone without any doubt. Landed behind them. If I would have given every tank commander a Sten gun and a rifle and said, we'll walk. It's only 10 miles to get to those men on those bridges. They held out for all those days, you know, John Frost for 5 days against panzer tanks, and that was it.
So that was Barry Wynn there speaking, and it's time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join me for the Politics Show at 5 in 2 weeks, no, next week, in fact, not in 2 weeks' time, and don't let the banksters get you down.
For Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.